Well, hi, everybody, and welcome to our Pro Football Weekly TV podcast this week. I'm Hub Arkish, along with longtime NFL head coach Dave Wannstedt and Hall of Famer Dan Hampton. Now, obviously, the next couple of weeks are all draft all the time, but this week we're going to focus a little less on this year's prospects and more on the draft itself. And Dave, I want to start with you because I'm guessing the majority of our listeners either didn't know or don't remember that in your first seasons as head coach of both the Bears and the Dolphins, you were also the general manager. So you've run NFL drafts before. You've run talent evaluation. I know there were a lot of a ton of things, but coming out of college, and then when Rod Graves, you know, came in as your GM with the Bears, and Rick Spielman, who was your personnel director for the Bears, came in as your GM with the Dolphins. How did the coach GM relationships work with you for those guys? And what was the one thing that you looked at as you were analyzing college players? The one thing that was the most important that you had to get, you know, a plus score on in order to find players interesting?
I would say the number one thing, Hub, would be, at least it's been with me, and this is going back to my days at the University of Pittsburgh when we were recruiting Dan Marino and we were recruiting Mark May and players like that. My old college coach, Johnny Majors, used to always say, let's go recruit players that do things that we don't have to coach. And it sounds funny and it sounds comical, but the thinking behind it was, let's get these guys that are playmakers and guys that can come in, and when you instruct them to do something, if it's not perfectly the way it's scripted, they've got enough instincts, they've got enough ability that they can still get off a block and make the play, or they can still make a guy miss in the hole and make a run or a catch or whatever it might be. So I think that would be number one. But the big thing for me was when they were talking about all these players, the first thing I wanted to see on the board was, let me see their production. And it kind of goes ties in hand with that. I mean, there's a guy that was with the Bears, and the guy was as good a looking player as he looked like Hamp physically. No body fat, strong and fast. And I was going to go up and work him out when he was coming out of college. We were at Dallas, and I said to Jimmy, we were talking, and he said, what's his production? And we put it up on the board, and I remember it like yesterday. The two of us sitting there, and we're saying, yo, this guy had as many sacks. We had guys at Miami that had this many sacks in two games, and this is what the production was for him all year. He's big, he's fast, he's strong, but he doesn't make enough plays. So if I were to say, hey, what's the number one thing that that we look for in every place that I've coached, college, NFL, Dolphins, Bears, Cowboys, it was always, are they playmakers? Can they do things that don't have to be scripted perfectly, take this step, take that step, take this step, that they can do things on their own and make plays? That's the guys that I always wanted.
Dave, just if I could just ask one other question real quick, though. And then as far as working with general managers, I know you've worked with a lot of different ones. What's that relationship worth like during these weeks leading up to the draft, where in most situations the GM has the final say, but obviously the head coach has a lot of input too. So what kind of different relationships did you have with those guys?
You know, that's a good one, Hub, because a lot of people out there think in the war room, as the draft room is called, that there's these big arguments of who you're going to draft. I would say this, I've been in a lot of them, been in 20 drafts, I think it was. And if there's an argument on draft day about a player with the head coach and the GM or the owner and the head, you've missed the boat. You didn't do your homework, because we would have so many mock drafts, we called them, and we would say, okay, and we would come to an agreement. And, you know, there were disagreements, but the thing that I think helps, these organizations that just let the scouts be involved and then the coaches, that's what Ron Wolf said this. I remember talking to Ron Wolf when he was GM of the Packers, and he said, Dave, let me tell you something. I would never draft a player that Mike Holmgren was not on board with him and his coaches, because I can draft him, and when he comes in, these coaches, if they don't like him, They're not going to spend the extra time with them. They're not going to develop them. They're not going to develop a relationship with them. And the guy's not going to be a good player for us, so we're going to end up cutting them, or we're all going to get fired. So I think the smart GMs and the smart coaches, they work through all those issues. You know, and there's been plenty of times with Rick. I remember that, hey, Rick, I kind of like this guy. But Dave, look at these three or four films. Look at this tape. And then he calls in the area scout. Coach, once that I was at practice and I watched this guy. It's not true. What we're talking about here is not really a reality. So, but my point is, so we get it worked out. So now you get in there on draft day, and you got your bullpen, as we called them, of players. And I haven't been involved, even when Jimmy did all of it pretty much at Dallas. Jimmy would turn to the scouts, and they've already been through the mock drafts. So all that dirty work, it sounds good. The media loves it. But the good organizations, it doesn't come down to draft day when they're on the board.
Dan, obviously the NFL and the draft were different worlds when you were the fourth pick in the first round by the Bears 45 years ago. But you've done what almost none of the rest of us have. So tell us, what was it like for you back in the day working out, preparing for the draft? And what was it like on your draft day, even though you didn't wait very long, waiting for your name to be called, and your first reaction when you found out you were a Chicago Bear where you'd spend your entire career?
You know, having the complete opposite perspective on this than what Coach Wonstadt does. Think about this. You know, I had no, what would you call it, insight into, you know, what most of the NFL teams would not only covet, but would, you know, value. You know, there's a bunch of 6'5", 260-pound guys that play football. And then, you know, when you start looking at the differences and then grading and, you know, performance, and as Coach just said, hey, production, all those different things. I didn't know, you know, what I didn't know. But now, as you just said, 40-something years later, I got a completely different opinion of so much of what happens in the draft. And by the way, Coach, I went back and looked at your very first draft as a head coach, young manager of the Chicago Bears. You had Curtis Conway, Carl Simpson, Chris Gedney, and Todd Perry. You got three or four starters out of that very first draft, didn't you?
Yes, we did. Yeah, they were all playmakers. You know, they all did something kind of unique for their particular position.
But as a player, you know, it's all about your world. It's kind of a finite situation where you know, it's not like you're looking at things from another perspective. And I'll never forget, and don't take offense, Coach. You know, growing up in Arkansas, having to play in the Southwest Conference, we had to play all those schools in Texas. So quite naturally, I hated the Dallas Cowboys because of, you know, just being – you know, the pipsqueak compared to the great big Texas all those years. Anyway, so I'll never forget. I think it was Cornell Green. Was that their cornerback scout? I'll never forget. He came to the cafeteria one night, and he handed out this, like, 30-page questionnaire that Landry and those guys were doing back in the spring of 79. And he said, you need to fill all this out and give it back to me. I was like, dude, I ain't going to fill this out. That'd take like 2 hours. He goes, well, if you don't fill it out, you're not going to be eligible for our draft table. And I guess I was kind of a punk, but I knew I was going to get drafted. Dallas was drafted like 25 or 6 or something. They'd been to the Super Bowl or pretty close. And I knew I'd be gone. And he said, you won't be eligible. I said, well, that's okay. I'll be gone long before you guys pick him. So I didn't, but it was a completely different, you know, perspective. And now looking at, you know, this year, and I think it's, you know, it's kind of cool we're doing this podcast and for us to be able to give our perspective on this year's draft and the quarterbacks. And we'll talk about it next week and the next week. But just think about, you're talking about production, Coach. I went through a whole bunch of insightful breakdowns this week. And you want to talk about somebody that didn't produce, that's Drake May. And yet, he is probably going to be the second overall pick. And yet, he doesn't have near the production of a Bo Nix or even McCarthy or some of these guys. So, yeah, on one hand, I think it's a beauty pageant. On the other hand, I think numbers and values have, you know, a big part in it. But I'll never forget when, you know, I was talking to my prospective agent at the time, and he told me that when Tampa Bay drafted Leroy Selman, that they said it was the easiest choice of all time because in their heart, they knew that's the guy we're going to build a team around. And if you as a coach, every year in the draft, you say, I want to build my team around a guy like this, makes it a lot easier, doesn't it, Coach?
Absolutely. Yeah, you know what's a funny story is Terry Bradshaw was telling me that Coach Halas had called him. There was going to be a coin toss in the 1970 draft between the Pittsburgh Steelers and the Chicago Bears. And Terry said, I'm down in Louisiana. I didn't know what either team was. And he said that Coach Halas called him and said, Terry, we're going to make you our quarterback, on and on. And he said he talked to Coach Halas at least one time. And so he said all of a sudden they had the coin toss, and the Pittsburgh Steelers win the coin toss. So he took his fishing pole, and he told his dad, I'm going fishing. And he headed down to the lake, and he said, an hour later or something like that, his dad's calling, and they're trying to get him. You know, there's no cell phones. And finally somebody runs down and gets him, and he goes back up to the house, and he says, Mr. Rooney from the Steelers is on the phone. They just drafted him. And he said he had no idea, but he thought he was going to be a Bear. You guys would have been teammates, Sam.
Isn't that crazy? Hey, and I'll tell you this. My draft, 1979, we drafted Willie McClendon, a running back from Georgia, in the third round. You know who was available, Coach? Joe Montana. and the Bears passed on him.
Well, you know, guys, Dave, I guess it's ironic that on the back end of our careers, we're all Chicago guys, and yet you were drafted by the Green Bay Packers. And I'm wondering, with your experience, which was very different from Dan's, there was still 17 rounds in the draft back in 1974, and you didn't get called until the 15th round. I'm wondering, what was your draft day experience like waiting through 15 rounds, wondering if and when you were going to go?
Well, there was no cell phones. I was home watching TV. You know, there was no draft on TV. There was no cell phones. And I had been married. I got married in December. And I was supposed to play. I got picked to play in the North-South All-Star game. And I really said, this is going to be an opportunity for me to go out there and compete against these guys around the country. And then we went to a bowl game, so I couldn't go. So, no, but you're right. Guys are better off being free agents now. You know, because when you get to that point, it's easy for the club. They sign you to a standard contract, but there was no agents back then. Dan Devine was my coach, speaking of, you know, Notre Dame and Green Bay, and then he got fired that year and everything kind of blew up. But, it was sitting on the couch. I think I was probably half dozing off watching TV.
You know, I wondered if Who was the best talent evaluator you ever worked with? Is there one guy in particular who's always stood out to you as, I can't believe this guy keeps finding more talent?
Oh, probably, I don't know. I mean, you know, I always thought that Rick Spielman and we had Rick Spielman and George Payton were my two guys in Miami. And I'll tell you what, you know, I thought both those guys were excellent. You know, they were excellent. And we spoke the same language, which makes a big difference. You know, we talked playmakers, and that's, they would be the first guys that come to mind, to be quite honest with you.
You know, Coach, let me ask Coach this. The one thing, and over the last 40 years, you know, going through all the years of draft and different player types and, you know, the best personnel people to me always seemed to be the ones that were always kind of like a Doug Plank character that was always, wasn't the most talented, wasn't the fastest, the strong, but the ones that worked harder, the ones that appreciated all the nuances and living on the edge. Those were the guys like a Rick Spielman, you know? I mean, he wasn't, I know he was a fine player in the NFL, but he wasn't like gifted. He wasn't, you know, a linebacker that everybody was, you know, lined up drooling over, you know, as far as talent. But he knew how to evaluate not only the talented players, but even the less than talented. We had it when Jimbo Covert was our first round pick in 83 from your Pittsburgh. We also signed a guard named Rob Fada. Did you ever hear of that name?
Oh, yeah. He was a good player.
Yeah, he was. But, I mean, he had no business being in the NFL. He, you know, small and slow. But you know what? Rob Fada made it a year or two just because he knew how to live on the margins, you know, and hold enough and cut enough and block enough and grab enough. And the guys like Spielman, they can recognize those traits.
And don't lose sight, too. You mentioned my school, Jimbo, Pittsburgh, where your head coach went to college, too, Coach Ditka.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, you know, it's funny that Pittsburgh has always had kind of drop to some of the things that I've, you know, been a part of in my NFL career. But let me just say this. You know, this draft coming up, and I don't, you know, everybody wants to be profound and all that, but how many times have the Bears swung and missed at the proverbial elusive franchise quarterback? And they've, you know, what essentially three times in the last 15 years. Think about it. I mean, you know, they gave up the world for Cutler and that blew up. And they moved up to get Trubisky at number two. That blew up. And now Justin Fields strikes out and is run, you know, out of Chicago. So this draft of all drafts, to me, has the earmarks of being one that the Bear fans and the franchise will either, you know, think their lucky stars are rue for the next 50 years, because it could all change with the drafting of you-know-who in a couple of weeks.
Well, guys, this is a question that I have for both of you. I'm going to start with Dan, but I'm curious to hear what you both think about it. And Dan, I'm wondering, what are the hardest and most important things for these rookies that get drafted to learn and adjust to in their first year in the league to make the leap from college to the pros? What's the first most important thing a really great college player has to do to become an NFL?
Well, when you know, you got to engage, you got to commit and jump in to the pool. And, you know, it takes a lot of guys. And even, let's go back to Curtis Conway. We mentioned his name. I don't think that he made the transition that quickly. It took a couple of years till he kind of got it and realized what was required to compete and be not only a starter in the NFL, but a leader and an effective player, all those different things. And you know what? A lot of times, some of these players, especially the high draft picks, they were the best kid in eighth grade and the best kid in high school, and they got recruited and they got the girls and they got, oh, you know, all the under the table money, and they never had been to a situation where they weren't the best player or that they weren't, you know, Mr. Perfect. So a lot of times I saw a lot of guys come in and they didn't know how to engage and kind of be a part of it. Now, it's funny, a lot of those guys kind of washed out. They were not the players that, you know, you can say, you know, years later made Pro Bowls, that they were the guys that, you know, you wanted to build your program around. But there was a whole bunch of them that did, like Jimbo Covert. Jimbo Covert came in, and the second practice of the first day, we went 2-a-days back then all the damn time. Crazy. Anyway, by the end of the second practice, I was telling Jim Osborne, a 14-year veteran, I told Jim Osborne, I said, that kid may be the best offensive lineman I've ever seen as a rookie. And Jimbo said, he may be the best offensive tackle in football right now. This is after the first day, second practice. So Jimbo knew how to do it. Now, other guys, maybe they didn't. there's a big, you know, gulf between some of the guys like a Jimbo Covert or Wilbur Marshall. Wilbur came in, and within, you know, a week, he and Mike Singleton, he was the best linebacker we had. Within a week of practice, he knew how to kind of engage, get it done, and become part of, you know, that whole, you know, defensive portfolio, if you will, and realize not only his value, but be able to you know, not be a prick and think it was all about him, but just realize, hey, for us to be great, I got to be special. Let me show you how I'm going
to
do it.
Dave, every year you'd bring in, what, 15 to 20, at least 12 to 15 rookies, you know, for I don't know how many years. What was the single most important thing for you to work with these kids to give them a good chance to succeed?
I think the guys that could handle the commitment and the length of the NFL season compared to college. In other words, to come in, you know, in college they have 15 days of spring practice. Their training camp, most of them start till school starts, you know, so they're in pads a week and then they're going to class. And obviously, Hamp mentioned 4 or 5 weeks of training camp. And even whether you're hitting like we all used to do it or like they do it now, they're still up at 6 and in the meetings and bed check and meetings till 10, 11 at night, OTAs, mini camps. I just think the mental grind that these guys, Hamp mentioned the word commitment. I think the mental commitment that these guys have to make to sustain you know, their performance over the length of a season gets a lot of them. They just can't handle it mentally, and they start making mental and physical mistakes, and it costs them a job.
All right, guys, another question for both of you. I'll start, Dave, with you this time. Who is the one pick you remember as the best player you guys ever drafted, no matter what round they came in? And who is the one high pick, probably a first rounder, who, you know, you expected to be a star, who turned out to be the least productive for whatever reason? I don't want to go after anybody individual, but I'm curious about who those guys might be.
You know, probably, I drafted a lot of kids, guys that you know, Hamp mentioned a couple of them. You know, Todd Perry played for about 15 years in the league, offensive guard. You know, Jimmy Flanagan, I drafted him at the Bears. We took him out of Notre Dame, like in the third round. And it wasn't about 2 weeks into training camp where it was evident that he was a better player than Chris Zorich was and that he should have been starting. And Jimmy was so smart. I mean, he played 3 technique. We slid him outside some. We put him at fullback. You remember that, Hub? Threw him a touchdown pass or two. he was a blocking fullback. You know, the guy was just a heck of a football player. He wasn't a Hall of Famer. But as far as a football player, you wanted him on your team. And the one that – I had a couple of them that broke my heart, you know – John Theory with the Bears. The guy had 15 sacks a senior year. He ran 4-5. I went down and visited him. The guy was in medical school. I mean, he was as good a kid, and he just couldn't, when he got to the NFL, it just didn't come together. Him and I drafted a corner out of Wisconsin. I'll think of it here as we're talking. We took him in the first pick. We had 2 picks. We took him in the bottom of the first round, and he won the Thorpe Award that year. I mean, the guy had 21 interceptions over his career. I talked to Barry Alvarez until I was blue in the face. It was the same year we took Chris Chambers. We took both those guys out of Wisconsin. And, you know, he just couldn't run well enough. We missed it. I missed it.
Dan, you must have gone through, 10, 12 drafts with the Bears. Who is the one player – the same question for you. The one player out of all those drafts who impressed you the most, and who was the one high pick that for whatever reason just didn't work out?
Yeah, I mentioned the two guys that I really felt like, you know, were difference makers for our team. And that would be Jimbo Covert and, of course, you know, Wilbur. But we had a lot of other first-round picks. You know, Donnell Wolford was a very solid player. Mark Carrier, my last year in the league, I think he set the Bear record for rookies, 9 interceptions. So, you know, he was a special guy. But, you know, at some point there are the guys that break your heart. And you kind of expect so much. You expect so much. And it just doesn't happen. And, you know, you can say what you will, but you know, we were always seemingly trying to find a tight end. You know, I don't know why we couldn't find a tight end. We, you know, would draft people and they just never really materialize. But, you know, it would have to break your heart as a head coach. And you know, coach, you're a part of a lot of these programs. And everybody needs to realize if you can find 3 starters in a draft, I mean, like, not guys just to hold their spots, but 3 players that could dominate and win their, you know, their share of the battles. If you could have 3 or 4 drafts like that, all right, now you've got 12, 15 players, you know, out of the 22 starters. So numerically, you're in a position where you can start not only believing you're going to win, but expect to win. And that's what the draft picks are. You know, obviously free agency, I went through the 2 free agent strikes, you know, of 82 and 87, which we all, you know, hated. Now that obviously these guys are making a fortune, and that was, you know, obviously the end game. But even going through those strikes, we still realize that, you know, for the long term, that having the ability to move around. And we had this, you know, talk last week about Buffalo, how they've cut they released both of their starting safeties. They let their center and another guard be signed away in free agency. And now Miami, you know, obviously looks to be better. But Buffalo, I mean, you know, that's the deal. The draft is everything now, you know, and free agency. Sure, if you have the cap room and the money, you can make a couple of big catches and you know, try to catch up to the great teams, but you got to build through the draft. And that's what makes what happens in a couple of weeks so special. It's the lifeblood of the NFL.
All right, guys, same question for you both again. And Dan, I'll let you go first this time. Once you finally became, well, I shouldn't say finally, the 4th pick in the first round, once you became a Bear, what were the biggest differences for you between playing in college and playing in the NFL? What was the biggest differences you had?
Well, I know this sounds crazy, but in college, everybody was a nervous wreck because Lou Holtz would put so much pressure on us to play a perfect game and play as hard as you could. And college was brutal. I mean, I loved it, and we accomplished a lot of really good things, but the pros – it was easier. And I know that sounds crazy, coach, but I'm just saying, you have your shit together and you show up and you practice and you know how to get after people, and they blow the whistle and here we go do it. That was easy for me, all the other stuff. But in college, I got to tell you, we were all nervous wrecks. I couldn't sleep the night before games. Yeah, all that being said, that it was great fortune that of my life that I've had so many great coaches, as you know Jimmy Johnson and then Lou Holtz and Monty Kiffin in college, and then of course Buddy Ryan and Ditka in the pros. So all that being said, I had the best coaching possible. But when we got everything kind of lined out, I don't want to say it was easy, but it was kind of easy. We knew what was expected. We knew what we had to do to prepare. And, you know, we just got after it. And I got to tell you, obviously I had 18 knee operations through my 12 years. I wish I could have played for 30 years, because once we figured it out, it was great.
I think the biggest difference is Jimmy had a lot of success as much as anybody at Dallas, and because we started with a young team. And, you know, I think a college coach comes into a veteran team. He's usually taking the job because a guy before him lost, so he got fired. And, man, that can be tough. That can be tough. Where if a coach is coming in and they pretty much clean the roster and they start from scratch, now the guy has a chance. He's probably recruited a lot of those young players. He can relate to those young players, and he can kind of build his culture with those young players. So, you know, the football is not the difference. Football is football. I was very shocked at that. When I came from college, I was nervous. Oh, boy, I'm a defense coordinator of the Cowboys now. Football was football. You work. Your hours were the same. None of that changed. It's just really, you know, working with the players, really. I mean, because players win games, not coaches.
All right, guys, we're running, bad habit of mine, we're running along again. But last question before we sign it off, and Dave, I'll start with you. Over all your years in the league, who's that one rookie that surprised you the most by becoming a Pro Bowl level player that you just didn't see coming?
Wow. You know, I would probably say that I didn't see coming. You know, I would probably say, I mentioned him before, Chris Chambers, the wide receiver we had at the Miami Dolphins. We drafted him in the second round out of Wisconsin. We all know Barry Alvarez, three plays and a cloud of dust. They didn't throw it much at Wisconsin. And we drafted Chris to kind of come in and be a complement receiver. And the guy just was phenomenal. And, you know, he would be one of the guys that would jump out at me as far as, you know, working his way into the Pro Bowl.
Hamp, how about you?
Well, and I, you know, obviously I didn't draft him or sign him, but when you get a free agent, it looks like a little pudgy, you know, giggly, soft kid that comes in and he's got 380 as his cholesterol level and he's taking his, you know, his socks and underwear home because he thinks he's going to get cut every week. And then the next thing you know, he turns into an all-pro center. That's a pretty good thing. And that's Jay Hilgenberg. Hilgenberg was signed as a free agent. And it wasn't Danny Neal, our center, hurt his neck. And he was given a spot. And he went on and made 8 Pro Bowls and was the heart and soul of our offensive line. So, you know, and again, you never see it coming. And then I've seen a lot of first rounders that you couldn't wait to cut them. You know, they don't have what it takes. But, you know, Mark Bortz, another guy, he was a seventh round defensive tackle from Iowa that Buddy Ryan told Ditka, hey, he's not going to make our defense. You need to put him at guard. What does he do? He goes on and makes a couple of Pro Bowls. And Randy White told me, may have been the best player he played against in the 80s. So you never know. You just got to take a chance on somebody.
Guys, back in 1983, myself and Joel Buxbaum and Mel Kiper were literally the only media people even covering the draft, preparing for it before it happened. We kind of invented that at Pro Football Weekly about 5 years before that. And in 83, in the 8th round, the 203rd pick from the University of Tennessee was Richard Dent. And I was probably the only guy in the media who even heard of Richard when he was drafted. He was not a starter as a rookie, but week 3, I remember, he got on the field early in the game, and a bunch of people in the press box said, what's he doing on the field? By week 4, he was playing half the game, and by 85 or 86, you knew he was going to be the Hall of Famer that he turned out to be. And the day they drafted him, I remember in Chicago, people went nuts. Who's Richard Dent? Well, he was another one of your future Hall of Famers. So, guys, we're running a little long again this week. We're going to wrap it up now. The next 2 weeks, all draft, all the time. You don't want to miss these. So we look forward to talking to you all again next week. And thanks so much for being with us this week.